Blog Talk Radio.
The interesting thing about the craft, there's a lot of interesting things. Hello everyone and welcome back to Masonic Effects. What's interesting is how subtle it is, the way it moves and begins to consume us. And it's an odd kind of an experience, isn't it, when we wake on so many different levels and realize that we seem to be living in with affirmations without necessarily conjuring up those, you know, interesting phrases that make us smile. You know, I can do anything if I try. Well, you know, it's a subtle little beast, this thing we call craft masonry. It's not so much anything and everything. It's what's meaningful and important and useful. And then, you know, it makes us sit back and re-examine what those things mean. It's the difference between just, you know, eating because you're starving and eating because you're savoring. The difference between existing and living. Between joy is escaping pain, and joy is something that is happening inside you. Imagine being in command like that, where you have a sense that as you realize that the conflict and tensions around you require your agreement, your capitulation to that. Thinking to that notion. And when you don't, what happens? Well, it's like somebody's just beating the dead horse, as they say. It's unpleasant imagery, but unless you're there to engage in that kind of tension, unless you let all of that all of those nasty those hormones that we need to be aggressive, unless we just release more, I mean, perhaps like some you don't even have control or awareness of it. It just happens and you think, oh my goodness, it's altogether normal. We find that this idea of control, it still puts a question to us, like, what now? I'm not buying into mood or the mindset of other people. I'm having my own, and I choose to live without those kind of tensions, and oh my goodness, there I am living without those kind of tensions. But it's different. Somebody can certainly strangle the life out of us, but in our minds and in our hearts, we don't have to live in fear. Oh my goodness, wouldn't you be afraid? Yeah, of course, but I mean, it's not a suggestion that that's a way of living, living with your guard and living in fear. It's suspicious. Oh, your reality is apparently the reality that is also has its place. All these other realities, people, ready to tell us that in their experience, humanity is not to be trusted, that the world is a harsh place. Well, you also have your own reality, your own position. Nah. What the stonemasons brought, you think about it, what they brought was this, before we get into the, dissecting it, as we always do, what they brought was this this notion, almost Arthurian notion of pride in the collective build. Oh, the transmission of skills from one generation to another. The accomplishment of beauty. The ability to pick up a plan and work with it and make it reality. They were the builders, and they instill that sense. It's a simple sense that a lot of us can embrace, whether you're working with your mind or with your hands. It's imaginative, isn't it? Do you think that they went on and we could say, well, on a practical basis, they times changed. They were still the craft, and this is a bit of a lesson to us. The times changed. They had to adapt, and they did. The way they adapted is by inviting these things, these people we call the speculative masons. Well, that's an afterthought to call them that. The boys didn't walk around saying, I think, hey, what do you make? We need some speculative masons running around here. Let's go get some. What they needed was resources. I appreciate that, and that they were resourceful and they knew how to solicit and get those needs met for the reason of sustaining the craft. Sustaining. It wasn't that one person had the idea, or one person, as we're taught, one person wasn't masonry. It was that skill set, wasn't it? It wasn't the people. We didn't even ask names. Who was it? Who was that mason that came up with this idea of apprenticeship? We don't ask names. We know roughly about the period. We know roughly about labor and roughly about their commissions that they had from the church and state at the time. Monarchs and church were incredibly economically powerful and controlling. Our resourceful lot found a way of digging themselves out of a bad situation. And they found it was quite eager. There was an eager group. They didn't put a billboard up. They didn't advertise it. They didn't have to. They went mouth to ear, just as we do today. It's not like those kind of skills or speech has lost all meaning. Come on now. We may not understand rhetoric, but we know we can read about it and learn about it and think, oh, that's clever. We should perhaps think about using that, being that way more often. We don't. Yet, often do that, unless you're in very, very specialized academic environments. What they did was they whispered to us, and you still hear it, that, hey, there's another way. If you want that kind of experience, we can help you to create it for yourself and then experience the growth that comes from that without you being part of that selective crew. You know, you, without being part of the advantaged or the elite, you can, we can teach you how to do yoga. Yes, that's right. You can have that privilege, that gain. And they taught us. Not in the laborious manuals that they knew would sit on the shelf in the workshop and collect dust. No, they went right after the question of how could they possibly replicate themselves? And then they had to take a long, hard look in the mirror and sort of what it was they meant by that. You know, of course, they weren't thinking genetically we're going to dominate the tribe here. No, they started to think in terms of, in abstract terms, the metaphors came out of that, the allegories came out of that. And if you're thinking, you have that mindset, you can think, well, that's not, coming up with the content is imaginative, but that idea that we, you know, what's going to connect to this conversation to a fellow 1,000 years from now? Well, first you would immediately ask, well, what language? You know, that's going to separate us, Tower of Babel and all that kind of malarkey. So how do you, that's also practical, not just the malarkey, but how do we overcome that? Well, we put up a symbol and leave it to the audience, to the reader, to decipher the symbols. We're away. We're away at the races. And now that made good sense. What symbols? Well, it's kind of obvious, you know. We have some symbols. They have to be symbols of intelligence and symbols of and reminders of monuments. And if they were astounding accomplishments, that wouldn't exactly be a bad thing. You can imagine those. Right now, if you ask me to think about things on the scale of the accomplishments of those, you know, 12th and 13th century Masons, I would be thinking something much earlier, Hadrian's Wall or the pyramids, that kind of scale. The craftsmanship of Machu Picchu and, you know, but I needed something more, you know, we could do that, but what about the whole matter of relevance? Something relevant to us, a cultural resonance, and that would make sense for me. That's enough. If I wanted to get into it, I would have to wonder why does it matter? And it may at some point. But what matters most is understanding the applications. What were the messages the old boys were sending to you and I? And so carefully manufactured in these symbols. Well, we can run with the notion of a symbol, and perhaps you have a poetic nature that you're able to expand on the meaning. If you it becomes purposeful when we add these other contexts or orbits, like spirituality. Oh, that. So we're talking now about things that are a little more serious. But the boys were smart enough to give us a brief thumbnail of the way we can work with each other past in their experience. And then as a measure that, you know, if you boys in the future are more clever, you know, certainly go beyond this, but this is the way that fits together in our mind. It's like the simplicity of Latin, isn't it? You know, the ideas are, there seems to be a clarity, and the way that ideas are worked seems more obvious. Yes, you're quite right to say we make small errors. So we're discovering that every day as we're refining the translations of scripture. Just before I sat down here with you, put down my copy of the Gnostic Gospels, and it's an eye opener and a mind opener. Changes things in a good way. The goodness is when we can park what we know, what we knew, and say, there's a better way. Maybe I don't need to be so afraid and concerned about it. The craft built that in with the embrace of arts and sciences, and that old bromide, arts and sciences. It's talking to us about, and suggesting that we look at the horizon in terms of progress. And my goodness, you start to scratch your heads, but a couple of hundred years on, it's easier to forget that or not pay much attention to it or drop that translation. And where I am, we've tried for quite some time just to breathlessly maintain someone's notion of what used to be. What used to be that doesn't exist anymore. We have a new version every day. Somebody new is coming along that's learning about this. We have new versions, thank goodness. And the science is progressive. So it isn't that it's an abstraction, something over there that needs to be progressive. It's that all of this, the purpose of all of this is you and me. The purpose of all of it is not to build a nation or a reputation, or it's not the control of the world banking system and control of anything. It's more about, it's certainly insight. Now, if we all gained the insight of Gandhi or the Buddha and then decided we need to control the world banks, not only would it be a disappointment, it would be a bit of a surprise. My goodness. We're something so trivial. You've done that kind of calculations to lead you to insight to way beyond the notions of currency, power, way beyond that. We give ourselves less credit than is due. Well, credit isn't ego. Credit is acknowledging. This idea that we all like to have some validation is curious, and it follows a lot of conversations that we have, but I think too often, and maybe you'd agree, maybe not, that it overlooks the primary issue. The first validation rests with you. The bottom line validation is yours. Not what I think about you or what I'm encouraging in you. It's my bias that potential doesn't mean a whole lot. He had such great potential. We're guessing. We're being optimistic and encouraging, and it's something I might say in certain situations. But if you ask me the truth, potential is unlocked by effort. Prove it. Prove it. And you had such potential to handle what's going on around you and much, much more with the grace. Prove it. You have the potential to contribute to in whatever walk of life you have. Well, that's a universality I can absorb. I can accept that. it, does everybody have equal access to that kind of state? No. The indignities we perform on other tribes and other people makes sure that we that there are people that are that have to reach within their own spirit, their own character in order to survive. Not that I would ever want to anybody to endure that kind of test. Ours may be more worse, maybe simpler if we do it in the mind. Create the challenge. Understand the challenge that we face. And then work diligently, never really knowing. I don't know anybody that I've ever met that lives like that or breathes and shares the air that we do and thinks that way. I think that I'm more inclined to find people that are worried. Either they're trying to, they're proud people. And I think that's a universal, some sense of pride. I immediately will launch into the story of some knucklehead that I've met, but that's because of my background. I wasn't the painter. I was the person that helped. I wasn't the illustrator. I was the person that helped fix the problems when they happened. And I had to struggle against that feeling of cynicism. Well, don't you just feel that you used to deal with it so much that everybody must be like that or the world must be consumed like that? But I have this sense of forthrightness, of courage, of faith and hope and dignity and potential. I'm not exactly good with a cup half full, half empty. It depends on the situation. But what is evident from my limited experience is this lesson, never underestimate. Never, never, ever. Because anytime I do, I'm wrong. Anytime I do, I'm wrong. So keep that in mind, I think. It's an interesting artifact. I think that I had that kind of belief system before I became a Freemason, and so did many of you. So did many of you. The pleasure is having that, being part of organized thinking that doesn't impose, but frees your mind. So it is, can be daunting for some. If you like to color between the lines, this isn't exactly the place where you're going to thrive. Is it fun to watch it evolve? Well, it is for the likes of me, I have to admit. And I get some satisfaction watching the struggle when I know that it's futile, know that you recognize these things, these phenomena for what they are. I get joy out of just knowing that. Not so much, being able to stop, because I don't cross that path. People's pride is essential. People need to survive, and if they're not having fun around me or enjoying me or they're critical, well, that's the price I pay. And in fact, if they're standing on their own 2 feet again and managing because of something I've done, it's not that they're going to feel they're at a parade or that they're going to necessarily respect what I've been able to contribute. They may, in fact, just hate that feeling. Proud people are like that. That sense of how do you feel that powerlessness when somebody that you love and care about is going to experience some pretty serious surgery. It's like that. surgical thinking. Before we get too much of the gore here, and simple way on whatever is pleasurable for you right now, whether it's that weather, it doesn't matter. You know, some if you want to the twinkle in your eye and you're needing a glass of scotch, well, by all means. And if for you it's a good time or it's healthier for you to have open a bottle of Pellegrino, yeah, go ahead. That's beautiful. Or a lovely tea, perhaps with a little lemon. You know? Maybe Earl Grey or Darjeeling. It depends on your time of day. Let me attempt to help you relax so that we can share some ideas. And we'll do that with a selection of music. This is from Esbjørn Svendsen. Yep, one of those Scandinavian types. Beautiful, beautiful trio. Winter in Venice, yeah. Thank you. I think we'll invite Hisborn, Svensson Trio back to the show. That was well worth the effort. I often began to notice that, you know, that there's trends that happen, and I began to question how. Why does it seem so difficult to pick up on trends and anticipate? Why do we wait until things go badly before we react or prepare or adjust? And so I pondered that. I looked at that. Yeah, I'm one of those kind of types. And so I've began to put myself to that test. When things are going well, how do I not succumb and feel, you know, that become that tedious bore that's always, you know, pleading that things are going to go bad, you know, some just, you know, such an unpleasant prat. That how do you do that when things are going well, to plan ahead and to ensure survivability in a way, not necessarily in its present form, but anyway, out of that kind of thinking, I conjured up this commentary for today, and I titled it Masonry as a Good Life. And maybe I was being a bit aspirational. Here, tell me what you think. Been long overdue, so taking up the hot topics of the days comes with no small measure of worry, especially when we tipple with the ideas of pantheism. Chaos, the fates, probability, call it what you like. The university is made whole when those variables become as predictable as the warmth of a sunrise or the salty taste of a tear. When conventional language is unable to explain phenomena, we can turn to mathematics and its twin, philosophy, to piece together meaning. If I thought that masonry was a constant source of understanding, I think I would quickly fall apart, knowing as I do how intimately incompleteness is part of life. Insights appear at the oddest time for the oddest reasons. So I don't walk around bending to smell a rose, but when I see roses, the idea occasionally floats across my consciousness. Is ignorance bliss? In my work, we call it the angel's kiss. When turmoil and distress fade and the mind rests in an oblivion with one inhabitant. What surprises and inspires passers-by is an engaging, curious attitude. Age does not set limits on it. To conjure up images of beautiful lodges, a table laden with taste to delight the guests, music to complement and entice the mind. I'd say making it reality begins with a little magical thinking. Why, I ask myself, whether it should be a requirement to encourage every brother who steps through the door with examples of the calmness that settles over us when we discover philosophies and tailor our thinking. Don't be fooled. There are active minds that do not wear an apron, capable of connecting with our beliefs that prove our words are more than idle thinking. There is disadvantage and suffering enough to drive us to accept nothing less than success in the way we influence the world. Equity, universality, more than words in the mind of a brother. Think of all those. Just think of the about acknowledging and affirming the connecting with the scholarship going on around us. Oh, there are small secret societies all over the world that aren't necessarily walking around with the same kind of branding that Masonry has acquired and is now rethinking. These societies exist all over the place if you look for them. Yeah. Academics do, music does, the arts all widely do. Mm. They're there and they're beautiful. They're beautiful. And they teach us. They teach us a great deal if we're inclined to the lesson. Mm. But here's a fellow who listened to his mom's advice. You put that baseball away, Ben, and go out and practice. You need to practice. One day, people will just be so enthralled by listening to you. You trust me. Then when you're practicing, she told him, think about how beautiful the music is. And you will discover your own. This is Ben Webster. Yeah. Beautiful. Thank you. So, a thank you to Ben's mom. Yeah, your little boy grew up to be pretty amazing. Got real talent. It prompted me to look at a poet that I've discovered recently. It ages me when I think that this fellow passed away in 1984. And he's largely forgotten. This is we're looking at the work of William Ebsen. And some of you might be familiar. Interesting guy. His idea of poetry was the expression of unresolved conflict. And I kind of like that. I think that's about where unresolved is. I can, you know, move on. I haven't got the time for it. Have no patience. And it makes me cringe when I think this is why young people think we're stupid when they see be around the tensions that old men feel, you know, quite justified in displaying to the world. Being short-tempered and largely stupid. It's not a stereotype. It's the truth. We sound that way when people look at us. Oh, and the folks that we intimidate aren't going to admit that, but come on, you know that. I was the cliche around where I am is to drive very slowly and just put on a fedora. And there's an old man with a hat driving slowly, oblivious to the world around. Probably should have his driver's license taken because, after all, stupidity. But this guy thought of poetry as unresolved. Now, who in the hell was this guy? Well, this is an interesting, just when you think, you know, we get kind of smug about this, well, the arts don't matter, you know, what's more important is business. Yeah, really? Business. You got that? Keep that. You bit down on that one, did you? Ebsen got a double first in Cambridge in mathematics and English, and he could have gone on to other academic distinction in either subject, and he chose English and became a literary critic of note. You kind of wonder what he could have done as a mathematician. His poetry right now is almost completely forgotten. Although in 1972, for those of you who were around in those days, the New Oxford Book of English Verse has two of his pieces. So not something to be, you know, dismissed. The poem, the style of poem today is is a villanelle. Yeah, and I should tell you what a villanelle is. It's an early form. It's sort of a shepherd's song, and ever since its origin, it's been used almost entirely for pastoral subjects or idyllic effects. And it seems simple, and in its simplicity. Is highly artificial. My goodness, if there's a statement that we could drag out and talk about it in terms of application of Freemasonry, that's it. Its simplicity is highly artificial, as may be seen from the structure. The villanelle is written in five three-line stanzas and ends with a stanza of four lines, and the refrain forming eight of the 19 lines. This one is talks about it is the pain. Missing dates. We'll talk about missing dates here. Sit back and see what you think about this. It clearly deals with death and lessening and regret, much like Dylan Thomas. But he saw one additional thread in it. So this is Ebsen reading your comments. Slowly the poison the whole bloodstream fills. It is not the effort nor the failure tires. The waste remains and kills. It is not your system or clear sight that melds down small to the consequences life requires. Slowly the poison the whole blood stream fills. They bled an old dog dry, yet they exchange rills of young dog blood gave but a month's desires. The waste remains, the waste remains and kills. It is the Chinese tombs and the slag hills usurp the soil, and not the soil retires. Slowly the poison the whole bloodstream fills. Not to have fire is to be a skin that shrills. The complete fire is death. From partial deaths, the waste remains. The waste remains and kills. It is the poems you have lost, the ills from missing dates at which the heart expires. Slowly the poison the whole bloodstream fills. The waste remains. The waste remains and kills. Sort of a weird feeling. This was a guy that was, we know that he was a cheerful and rather promiscuous person. But this kind of poem suggests much, there's something much deeper about him. Remember that the best known villanelle. These tend to be, you know, these are shepherd songs. My goodness. Do not go gentle into that. Good night. Or Elizabeth Bishop. The art of losing isn't hard to master. Epson. What do we learn from that, if anything? I just want to be prancing around in the meadow with those daffodils out there, you know, and then a nice summery breeze, and yet I'm putting on a mask and there's a plague going on. And people are dying all around me. And the airwaves are full of cynicism and some really, really outrageous kinds of comments about people wanting to define us and control us. Can you imagine the surprise when they run across this lot of Freemasons? Because we're like those little those little creatures that just immediately pop underground. We'll just disappear for a while. And then disappear from you, and you'll go on with your business, and then, you know, we'll be back when it suits our purpose. Because we do represent, gentlemen, we do represent a spirit, an enduring spirit. Here, so does George Winston. Thank you. history, you know. History seems to reveal so much when we about our future when we study it. Not that studying something means we're consumed. My goodness, we have a capability of studying and appreciating something that we may disagree. We may find the premise unsuitable or inadequate. And so, but we have a capability to study it and reason it through. Opposing ideas, I think, was the way it was said once upon a time by a person much smarter than me. We're going to talk today about the period in history, a reflection by Margaret Jacob, the historian, a reflection on the atmosphere and the zeitgeist surrounding masonry back in the day, 18th century. And I put a little footnote to myself to be careful. I think that's the creator teaching me, be careful. You're going to choke yourself on these words here, man. This is and you'll understand quite quickly as you will allow here, fed by the unprecedented affluence and prosperity to be found among the 18th century English middle and upper classes. The Masonic affection for private luxury also induced a certain discomfort among its very participants. This is not to say that in general we find in this literature anything like the sustained attack on decadence and corruption, on greed and commercial interests that was so much at the heart of country sensibility. Indeed, the Masonic acceptance of commerce and glorification of the industrious and prosperous entrepreneur permitted only the occasional reflection on the dangers of luxury and overindulgence. The Freemason coveted affluence. He wanted prosperity, but without decadence. His is the conscience of those Whig gentlemen who wanted to live like the court and reap its benefits while managing somehow to avoid the inevitable slide into licentiousness and corruption. So the Masonic publicists emphasize the ritualistic and fraternal aspects of food, drink, and song, seeking to make them into symbolic expressions of Masonic unity, harmony, and moderation. Yet the drinking songs sung in the lodges give ample evidence that the Bacchanalian thrived and may even have provided an occasion for the safe expression of dissident ideas, which in the context were rendered harmless. Take, for example, this verse. Let monarchs run mad with riches and power. Fat gown men will dull the philosophers sour. When the claret goes round and the company sings, we're wiser than sages and greater than kings. In contrast to that harmless ribaldry, most Masonic literature places great emphasis on decorum, civility, and table manners, literally on forks, plates, and napkins. One of the primary functions of the lodge was to make all its members, regardless of birth, into well-mannered gentlemen who help instill public order. For the Freemason, society alone is the source of man's greatest happiness, and as a result, he has a particular obligation to foster socially acceptable virtues. There is limited evidence that membership in the London lodges did modify the public behavior, of brothers and hence contribute to the increasingly orderly forms of public recreation that became common in the latter decades of the 18th century. For instance, the epilogues and prologues given in London playhouses and especially intended for Masonic audiences frequently refer to the virtuous and peaceful behavior of the assembled lodge members. Their deportment was apparently in noticeable contrast to the near riotous assemblies for which the everyday audiences of the playhouses were well known. Those Masonic evenings in the London theaters were frequently accompanied by a special charity collection for a brother or his widow fallen on hard times. Charity to the deserving poor or the needy brother formed an important part of Masonic ideology, if not practice. In advertising the benefits of membership in a continental audience, that anonymous French tract of English origin mentioned earlier claimed that the order always took care of its own, even to the point of providing free medical care for members when a lodge was lucky enough to possess a fraternal doctor. There may be some truth to these charitable claims, and the available evidence suggests that the lodges functioned as a hedge against the uncertainties and insecurities of an increasingly pervasive market society. Certainly, Masonic loyalty could be tangible. It could extend even to the victims of crime if their assailants were Masonic and if, as I suspect, the good name of the order was threatened. In the 1930s, members of the Horn Tavern Lodge gave assistance to a woman who had been raped by one of their members. Yet they did not abandon him even after he was imprisoned for the crime. For political crimes such as fomenting revolution, the constitutions of 1723 specifically forbade expulsion of a brother, although it did insist that the loyal brotherhood must and ought to disown his rebellion. 18th century Masonic literature, both British and continental, offered the lodge as the foundation for earthly happiness, provided an ethical system that emphasized fraternity and equality as well as the value of liberty. Don't be stunned, especially about that matter about the rape victim. And think about it. They kept the fellow in the lodge while they were debating and discussing and caring for his victim. What escape? What bravado? They wouldn't let the fellow dismiss her. Ever. No paying your debt back to society, no squaring yourself. Did what you did. You are what you are. And we're going to allow you, not for anything that came out of you, but because part of the way that masonry differs. Thank you. the friendly giant used to say, I see from the clock on the wall that we have to go. The show is coming to an end. Thank you for sitting in and joining us today. Keep the big picture in mind when you go about your work. This order, this connection that we have around the planet, it does exist. And it's not as frail as our critics might tend to think. But it is such an odd situation, an odd experience, isn't it? No recognition, no fanfare, no pat on the back. Doing things because you know they're the right thing to do. Where do we teach that kind of ethic? Where do we learn that? Maybe Jung is onto something. There's something in our genes that is a language that some of us have acquired a long, long time ago. Anyway, we can celebrate and be joyful about what we have, what we experience. We're fortunate. We're part of the fortunate few. Commit those acts of random Masonic kindness and be gentle with yourself. I look forward to being with you again soon. Bye for now. Thank you.